to struggle, and to talk if they survive.
But it doesn't really fit the pattern, does it?
Cyrus asked, still unclear.
She's only killed infants, that we know of, because she's had trouble with them during that stage of life.
It's a wrinkle, Cyrus, to be sure, the doctor answered, toying with a pen on his desk. But the overriding similarity remains. The children were attacked, and the attacker's intention was clearly to kill them all.
Marcus let out a stunned kind of sigh. If this whole thing weren't so horrifying, I'd say it was getting ridiculous.
Far from it, Marcus, the doctor answered. This news only confirms the entrenched nature of her tendencies. Her past is at one with her present behavior.
The doctor's voice grew quieter as he mouthed the words that were the closest thing he had to a motto.
The keys are in the details.
He stood up and turned to look out the window of his study at the small garden behind the house.
And those details are upstate, not here. If we wish true progress, then we must go.
Is that smart? Lucius asked. If we leave, she may think we've given her the field, and God knows what'll happen then.
We shall not leave before the two of you confront her, Detective Sergeant, the doctor replied. And now you can include our awareness of this incident in your statement. We can only hope that such awareness will make her act with even greater caution, because if we stay here, we will remain stymied. The past is our way in. We must follow it.
Marcus spoke again very carefully. And the other matter, Doctor? How do you feel about leaving with your own affairs unresolved?
The doctor shrugged. As you both have said, Marcus, there is little I can do before the hearing. If there had been any secrets to unearth, I know that you would have found them. Whether I stay or go is of little consequence.
Watching him, I saw something that seemed almost like bitterness enter his face.
And I confess, he continued again softly, that I have never been so weary of this city, or its citizens.
He shook the moment off and turned to face us.
Getting away may be the best thing all the way round.
No question about that, Mr. Moore said cheerfully, especially given the destination. Saratoga's absolute heaven at this time of year, and when you add the diversions.
Everyone else in the room smiled and groaned, and Miss Howard picked up a book to fling at Mr. Moore.
Yes, we all know why you want to go, John, but you'll have precious little time for your usual pursuits.
I'm just talking about our off hours, Mr. Moore protested, shielding himself. We can't work day and night, you know, and let's face it,
Saratoga is a vulgar, disgusting sty, Miss Howard finished for him, where fat, wealthy men gamble, lie to their wives, and make panderers and prostitutes rich.
The harshness of the words made it clear that she sincerely meant what she said.
Oh, you sound like your friend Nellie Bly, Mr. Moore replied with a wave of his cigarette. Besides, I'm not married or fat.
Give yourself time, Miss Howard returned. And as for Nellie, everything she wrote about that wretched place in the world was true, and it took great courage to say it.
Yes, Mr. Moore countered, almost as much courage as it took to marry that 75-year-old millionaire of hers.
Miss Howard's eyes went thin, and she poised herself to strike. Mr. Seaman is not 75.
No, he's 70.
Marcus had said the words absent-mindedly, but a glance from Miss Howard was all it took to make him regret it.
Well, I'm sorry, Sarah, but he is.
My God, it's a miracle the human species still exists, Miss Howard seethed, with apes like you carrying it forward.
Children, children, the doctor clapped his hands. We have far more pressing matters to deal with. It's now Monday evening. How soon can we all be ready to depart?
Tomorrow, Mr. Moore answered quickly, obviously dying to get up to the great American resort town of Saratoga Springs, where, as Miss Howard had said, gambling, whoring, and philandering had long ago pushed taking the waters out of the way to become the chief pastimes.
Marcus and I'll need a bit longer, Lucius threw in. I don't think we'll have any trouble selling Captain O'Brien on the idea that we're going along to watch your movements, Doctor, but it may take a couple of days to tie everything up, and, of course, there's that little visit to Bethune Street to make.
Very well, the doctor answered. Shall we say
Thursday morning.
There was general agreement to this idea, and the doctor grabbed for his copy of the Times.
We can take one of the paddle steamers as far as Troy, and from there the train to Ballston Spa. Moore, as for going on to Saratoga, you'll have to arrange that yourself.
Mr. Moore grinned wide.
That won't be any trouble. They've put in an electric trolley from Ballston to the center of Saratoga. 15 or 20 minutes, and I can be standing in front of Canfield's casino.
I'm delighted for you, Miss Howard mumbled, what you might call acidly.
Mr. Moore just grinned at her.
Stevie, the doctor said, and I snapped to it. In the morning you'll go down to the 22nd Street Pier, see what embarks Thursday morning. Try for the Mary Powell if she's available. I prefer her private parlors, and she's generally less crowded than the other daylines.
Right, I said. How many parlors?
We should need only one, the doctor said. But get two in the event that the rain doesn't subside. As to packing, I should recommend planning on a month's stay to be safe. Moore, I leave the hotel accommodations to you and Sarah.
All right, then, everyone, let's waste no more time.
At that, we all left the room and split up to start packing and preparing. The prospect of getting out of New York in midsummer quickly began producing its usual effect, relief and a giddy sort of joy, despite the disturbing things we'd learned from Mr. Rupert Picton. If we had to pursue the miserable case of Libby Hatch, it would be a sight more pleasant to do so in the green wilds of upstate New York than in the sweltering heat of Manhattan. That, anyway, was what we thought at the time.
Chapter 27 Things were humming on 17th Street for the next couple of days. We not only had to pack our things, but board the horses and close up the house itself for what might be an extended absence. And then there was the job of finding somebody to look in on the place occasionally, somebody less destructive and, hopefully, with a better command of English than Mrs. Lesko. The doctor eventually snuck an offer through Cyrus to one of the custodians at his institute, a fellow he knew could use some extra money, and through the same agent the man agreed. Luck was with us all the way around on this score, because when we told Mrs. Lesko we'd be leaving and that she wouldn't be needed while we were gone, she said, or at least as best we could tell, she said that such was just as well, being as she wasn't going to be able to work for us anymore. It seemed that she and her husband had decided to head out west to try their luck opening a restaurant in a silver mining town in Nevada. The doctor, relieved that she'd spared him the job of firing her, gave her 2 weeks' salary and a nice-sized bonus to boot. But none of us was what you might call optimistic about the prospects of her actually selling her cooking. We tended to doubt that even miners got that hungry. As it turned out, the Mary Powell was indeed making a day run up the Hudson on Thursday, and I was able to book us two private parlors. It continued to look like this was a wise precaution, being as the rain didn't let up all through Tuesday. That afternoon, Mr. Moore and Miss Howard, still bickering about the morality of the wild activities of Saratoga, came to the house at 17th Street to wait with us for the detective sergeants who'd gone downtown a little earlier to put Libby Hatch on notice as to what we knew about her. It was a nervous few hours that we spent in the parlor, with Cyrus trying to keep everybody calm by playing the piano softly. But despite his efforts, the building wind and rain outside seemed to say that some kind of calamity was on its way. That particular fear, however, turned out to be uncalled for. The detective sergeants showed up at about 5 in very relieved and slightly tipsy spirits. Their visit had gone as well as they could have hoped for. The mistress of number 39 Bethune Street had once more tried to play coy and seductive with them, and had even invited them inside again, but they'd stood their ground and said their piece right there on the doorstep, with the rain and the runoff from the roof pouring down on them. They'd listed every important point that we'd devised, both false and true, starting with the declaration that the police department was aware of what she was doing, and then moving on to our knowledge of her secret hideaway in the basement and the doctor's continuing to serve as a special consultant on the case. They'd wound up with the announcement that they'd figured out what had happened in Ballston Spa 3 years ago and were on their way to confirm their suspicions. If anything happened to her husband in the meantime, they said, or if a baby answering Anna Linares's description turned up dead somewhere, she could look forward to a date with the electrical chair at Sing Sing. It was true that few women got executed in the United States, they told her, but someone with her murderous record could definitely count on gaining entry into that select group. Lucius described the woman's reaction to all this. She'd gone from playing the coy temptress to forcing some tears and protesting her innocence, then moved on to saying that the detective sergeants just didn't understand the extenuating circumstances of what she'd done, such being Lucius's phrase, not hers. Finally, pure malevolence had made its way into those golden eyes. That was the only moment, both the brothers said, when they'd become truly unsure of what they'd started. They were, after all, in the heart of Hudson Duster territory and open to attack from the gang. Assuming that Libby Hatch felt like having her boyfriend's thugs tend to the matter and didn't just shoot the pair herself. But the Isaacsons had warned her that plenty of people in the department knew where they were and what they were doing, and if they didn't make it back to headquarters, nobody'd have any trouble figuring out why. When he and Lucius walked back to the cab they had waiting, Marcus said he could feel the pure hatred coming from the doorway of number 39, like bright sunshine on bare skin. Then, as they left, they'd heard a loud slam of the door and a small cry of rage from inside. But they'd made it out of the neighborhood without any trouble and had stopped on their way to the doctor's house only long enough to calm themselves down with a quick shot of rye and a short beer, a rare thing for Lucius, at the old town bar on 18th Street and Park Avenue. And so, as Mr. Moore put it, war had been declared, and directly to our enemy's face. But the doctor was quick to remind him that while we could be happy that all had gone well and the detective sergeants were safe, thinking of Libby Hatch as our enemy was not going to help our cause. We were on our way upstate not only to learn exactly what she'd done, but why. And while it might be tough, given all the things we knew about her, to try to see things as she'd seen them during her years of growing up and becoming a mother, it was more important than ever that we do so. Talk about enemies and a war wasn't going to help that process. If we were ever going to understand what had driven the woman to her past and current acts of violence enough to guess at her next moves, we were going to have to let go of the image of her as the devil's handmaiden. She was a person, one who'd been made capable of unspeakable things by unknown events, what we would never really appreciate if we couldn't see them through the eyes of first the girl and then the young woman she'd once been. This was all sensible talk, and I'd heard similar from the doctor many times before, and maybe if the weather had calmed down at all on Wednesday, it would have been easier for me to stay equally reasonable. But dawn that morning saw the sky black and every window in the house starting to rattle in its frame. By noon, a howling gale had roared up from the southwest to slam into not just the city, but the whole eastern part of the state as well. Up in Matawan, we later learned the rain was so heavy that a whole set of dams burst and 8 people were killed in the flood that followed. Maybe it's true that what goes on in the sky is just weather and doesn't signify anything more. But the notion that we'd stirred the wrath of some powerful being somewhere flitted into and out of my head all day long as we made our final preparations for departure the next morning. By late Wednesday evening the storm was still raging, and I still hadn't seen or heard anything from Cat. As the night wore away, I realized with ever more misgiving that she would likely end up leaving for California while we were upstate and, lacking any way to contact me there, would think I had no interest in what had become of her. Caught up in such thoughts, my mind was tormented for several hours with the question of whether I should make a quick circuit of her usual haunts. When she'd been at the doctor's house, she'd left me with the notion that she wouldn't be going back to the Dusters, but the amount of cocaine what had clearly been in her body when she'd come to number 808 Broadway had made me doubt that she'd kept completely clear of the place. And as I sat in my room and watched the lightning, thunder, and rain throw branches of the trees in Stuyvesant Park first one way and then another, my doubts only multiplied. Did she have a flop, I wondered, on a night like this? She had the money to afford someplace decent, that was certain, or had she already spent it on a Bernie binge? Had Ding Dong found out about her good fortune and forced her to fork it over? Could she count on anybody besides me to care enough to find out? I hoped so, because no matter how fretful I got that night, I found that I just couldn't head out the door. I told myself it was the high winds and the rain, but a voice inside me answered that I'd spent plenty of time wandering the streets in weather like that. Then I protested that it was her place to come to me for once if she needed help. But I knew that, mad as she'd been when we parted, she never would. The plain truth was that I didn't know why I couldn't go out to look for her. I was worried whether I'd ever hear from her again. I was worried about where she was and what she was doing. But I simply couldn't go after her. And I couldn't say why. I woke the next morning to find that the great storm had blown out to sea. Sunshine and a light breeze were quickly drying the city while the temperature had finally dropped into the 70s. There were a few branches on the grass and walkways of Stuyvesant Park, but other than that, the tempest didn't seem to have left any permanent scars in our neighborhood. It wasn't yet 7:30, but the carriage the doctor had engaged to take our bags and ourselves down to the 22nd Street Pier would arrive in just half an hour, and the Mary Powell was due to get underway at 9. So I dressed and cleaned up quickly, sitting on the lids of the big suitcase and small valise the doctor had given me so that the things would close, and then banging my way downstairs with them. Cyrus and the doctor were both awake, the doctor in his study packing books and papers, and Cyrus in the kitchen once again making coffee. By the time it was ready, the three of us were too. We'd stacked our bags and trunks by the front door and had nothing left to do but drink Cyrus's strong coffee and grow ever more anxious to get on the boat, the first of which activities only aggravated the second. I made a last round of the back door, the yard, and the carriage house, sneaking myself a smoke as I made sure everything was locked down tight. Then, finally, the hired rig appeared. The driver, an old German who the doctor spoke to in his native language, helped us get the bags aboard, and then we turned to say our goodbyes to the house, not knowing just when we'd pass through the little iron gateway to the front yard again. The weather only improved as we made for the Hudson, the breeze remaining mild, and the sky marked by just a few large, quick-moving clouds. When we reached 9th Avenue and 22nd Street, I stuck my head out of the carriage and looked ahead to the pier. The Mary Powell was docked and surrounded by a large crowd. We crossed over 10th and then 11th Avenues, and as we did, the number of people and rigs making for the pier steadily increased. The smell of the river and the prospect of going someplace new and exciting were making my blood positively race, but I didn't know how agitated my movements had become till the doctor threw a playful arm round my head, telling me it was the only way he could think of to keep my skull from exploding. Our fellow passengers at the pier seemed to be as excited and relieved by the sudden change in the weather as we were. Most of them weren't near as laden down with baggage, though. Ships like the Mary Powell catered mostly to day cruisers, and we didn't have any trouble finding a porter to help us with the bags. I told the doctor that I'd help the man get them off the carriage and on board the ship if he and Cyrus wanted to go ahead and check our parlors to see which other members of our party had arrived. This they did, and I quickly commenced moving the luggage onto the amiable Italian porter's hand truck with the assistance of our big German driver. I didn't understand a word what either man said. But that didn't matter. The sight of the river steamer all decked out and ready for the voyage, her twin stacks and big side paddles signifying confidence and power, together with the excitement that was coursing through the merry collection of people both aboard the ship and on the pier, kept me moving in a happy, spirited, and sure fashion. Strange what little things can change your mood faster than spit. A sound, maybe? Or even just a smell can sometimes twist your thoughts and feelings worse than hours of conversation or days of experience. For me, that morning, it was a sight, just a glimpse, really, of the person I least wanted to see in the world. Ding Dong. He was sitting about 30 yards away, atop a big pile of freight on the wharf, but his eyes were honed right in on me. His vicious features were twisted by the same evil idiot grin that was generally in evidence, and as soon as he knew I'd caught sight of him, he jumped to the ground, grinned even wider, and made a vigorous, obscene movement with his hands and his pelvis. I got the message all right. Cat had gone back to him. It hit me hard, forcing my eyes to the ground and my jaw to fall open. Then a voice sounded from somewhere inside my own head. "Of course she went back to him," it said. "She didn't have anywhere else to go, thanks to you." By the time I looked back up, Ding Dong had vanished into the crowd. Most likely, he'd trailed us from the doctor's house and, satisfied to see us leaving town, just wanted to send me off with a personal message that'd make my heart as sore as I'd made his face. He'd succeeded, all right. I dropped the suitcase I had in my hand and just kind of collapsed onto it, so dazed that I barely heard a familiar voice, this one definitely outside me, calling, "Stevie!" It was Mr. Moore moving my way with a suitcase of his own in hand. A porter carrying a trunk was trailing behind him. "Stevie!" he said again as he reached me. Then he crouched down. "What is it, kid? What's going on? Where's the doctor?" I shook myself hard, trying to get rid of the shock. "They went aboard already. I'm bringing our stuff with the porters." Mr. Moore put a firm hand on my shoulder. "Stevie, has something happened? You look like you've seen a ghost." "Not a ghost." I couldn't go into a full explanation, but a piece of one was called for. "Dusters. Must have followed us here." Spinning to search the wharf, Mr. Moore squinted. "They didn't get on the boat, did they?" "Nah," I said. "They're gone. Just letting us know they're still watching." "Uh-huh," Mr. Moore answered. "Well, come on. With any luck, we'll be out of town long enough for the dusters to forget all about us." I got back up and moved with him toward the gangplank of the Mary Powell, our porters following close behind. "It's not like you to let them rattle you this way, Stevie," Mr. Moore said, punching my shoulder lightly. "Though after that brawl, I guess I can understand it." I didn't answer, just nodded and tried to get my breathing back to some kind of regular pace. By the time we got on board, I'd almost managed that much, too, but the burning rock of guilt in the pit of my gut wasn't going anywhere. Once on the ship, Mr. Moore and I let our porters lead the way to our private parlors. Located amidships on the port side upper deck, they were handsome rooms indeed, with trimmed wood paneling, rich furnishings, and windows that could offer us views not only of the Palisades cliffs soon after our departure, but the Catskills and other handsome mountains along the way. For the moment, though, all such pleasures and advantages were lost on me. Once I'd seen the bags safely into the rooms, where the doctor, Cyrus, Miss Howard, and the detective sergeants were already lounging and exploring happily, I mumbled something about wanting to get a look around the ship, and left quickly. Down on the main deck, just forward of the large dining rooms, I found a public men's room and entered it, getting a bit of a skeptical glance from the old attendant as I did. Locking myself into one of the toilet stalls, I leaned against the tiled wall on one side and lit up a smoke, trying to drive away the devilish thoughts and feelings what were tearing at my insides. I hadn't made much progress before I heard the attendant outside the stall. He cleared his voice with purpose and said, "This washroom is for gentlemen," which was not the kind of attitude to take with somebody in my condition. "This toilet is for passengers, mug," I snapped back. "So go chase yourself unless you want to finish this trip with a busted arm." I heard the man take a deep, angry, and insulted breath, but he didn't say anything, and as I took another deep drag off my smoke, I remembered that he was just doing his job. "Don't worry, pal," I said quietly now. "I'll be gone in a second." I allowed myself another minute or two's smoking, then dropped my butt into the toilet and headed out without looking at the attendant. As I headed back up the wooden steps to the upper deck, a huge bellow came out of the ship's main whistle. We were getting underway. Not yet ready to return to the others, I went on up to the promenade deck and got as far forward as I could, cramming myself into the narrow little corner of space between the outer railing and the steering house. I was on the starboard side of the ship, away from the pier so that I couldn't see the crowd ashore. Then the Mary Powell started to slowly move out and away from the waterfront. Before long, we'd eased out to the middle of the river, where the big side paddles engaged with a loud rumble and rush. Not loud enough, though, to quiet that same voice in my head. "She ain't like you," it said. "She didn't grow up in this town. She's never understood it, really, no matter what she says. And you stood there and let her wander right back off into what you knew was trouble, just because she embarrassed you." Lost in all this bitter thinking, I pretty near jumped clear of the deck when I heard the doctor's voice behind me. "You won't see very much from this side," he said, joining me at the rail. "Or did you want to watch the city fade behind us?" I turned back, to look at the waterfront of Hell's Kitchen as we moved steadily past it. "Something like that," was all I could say. The doctor nodded, and for a few more silent moments, we just stood there. "We'll be coming up on the palisades soon," he finally said. "Shall we go to the other side?"
"Sure."
I peeled myself off the rail and followed him round the back of the wheelhouse. On the ship's port side, the distant view before us changed as dramatically as if we'd stepped into another world. On our left were the small, quaint houses of Weehawken, New Jersey, while in front of us, the sparse outskirts of other towns formed a picture what was similarly humble and peaceful. Soon, greenery closed in completely on the river, not to be interrupted again until we reached those giant brown and gray slabs of rock that rise hundreds of feet into the air for miles on end and are known as the Palisades. The cliffs were the first of many remarkable natural wonders what the Hudson had to offer the day traveler, and their effect, like the river's itself, was to reassuringly remove a person from the immediate cares of the human world. As we stared at those rocks, the doctor took in a deep breath, then let it out in what seemed to me a peculiar combination of relief and consternation.
"This is a strange case, Stevie," he murmured. "Strange and disorienting. The human mind does not readily accept such events and possibilities."
Continuing to look out at the Palisades, he held up a hand.
"And do you know, I cannot help but think of my own mother, when considering it. Is that odd, do you think?"
"I don't really know," I answered. "Depends on what brings her to mind, I guess.
A simple realization, really. I have always been unable to understand why, when things between my father and myself were at their worst, my mother never intervened. Even when I was only 3 or 4 years old, and utterly unable to defend myself, she never involved herself."
His eyes seemed to be questioning the water, forest, and rocks before us, as if they might offer him some clue to the matter he was contemplating. There wasn't any sense of self-pity in the look, for the doctor despised and avoided such tendencies. It was just a kind of honest, sad questioning, and he was entitled to wonder. From the time Dr. Kreitzler had arrived on this earth, it seemed, the people closest to him had been either a vexation or a heartache, and sometimes both. His father, a rich German publisher who'd come to America after the European revolutions of 1848 went bust, had had it in for his son right from the start. Though in society circles the old man was a popular and admired character, at home he was a boozy tyrant who treated his Hungarian wife and his two kids, for the doctor had a sister who currently lived in England, to the backs as well as the fronts of his hands, fists too. I didn't know just what had made the doctor bring the subject up that day, but I was grateful to think and talk about anything other than Cat. "Maybe she didn't know what was happening," I said with a shrug, "or maybe she was afraid he'd lay into her even worse than usual if she did anything." The doctor's face filled with a look that said he'd considered such suggestions many times. "As to her not knowing," he said, "that seems unlikely, if not impossible, given her own violent relationship with the man. And as to her not wishing to incur his wrath, she did so deliberately far too often for me to accept that proposition. I have always known that his violence toward her gratified some perverse part of her psyche. But the violence toward my sister and myself? I don't think she relished that." He squinted a bit and seemed to be struggling with an idea. "No, since we began this case, another possibility has presented itself to me. The thought that, although my mother cared for her children, their welfare was simply not her first priority. And the real question is not why that should have been so, but why it should have been such a difficult theory to either formulate or accept. Why, indeed, it should have taken a murder case to make me think of it. After all, a man who makes his children of secondary or even minor importance, though he may be criticized by some, is hardly held to be unusual. Why should we believe any differently of a woman?"
"Well,"
I found myself saying, simply and automatically, "Because she's your mother. It's only natural." The doctor chuckled. "That answer from you, Stevie?" I realized the stupidity of what I'd said and tried to cheat my way out of it. "Well, it's not like we're talking about my mother."
"No. In such discussions, we never seem to be talking about anyone's mother. We seem to be talking about what Sarah would call an abstract, a myth."
The doctor took out his cigarette case.
"Have I ever told you about Frances Blake?"
"The woman you almost married when you were at Harvard?" I asked.
"The very same. She would have surprised you. Wealthy, a gadabout, fairly intelligent, but too personally ambitious to take the time to develop her insights. Just ask Moore. He quite disliked her."
Lighting his cigarette, the doctor chuckled.
"As I grew, too, eventually."
He blew out some smoke, and his face took on a puzzled look.
"She was not unlike my mother in many ways."
"So what was the attraction?" I asked.
"Well, in addition to some more obvious factors, she had a rather vulnerable side, one that seemed to allow her to understand the destructive foolishness of much of what she did. In my youthful naivete, I believed I could nurture that side of her until it became dominant."
"So, you wanted to change her?"
"Do I detect censure in your voice, Stevie?"
the doctor asked, laughing quietly again.
"Well, you're right to put it there. I behaved idiotically. Imagine, contemplating marriage to a woman simply because you perceive her as vulnerable to change. She wasn't, of course. As pig-headed as, well, set in her ways, shall we say."
I looked down at the waters of the Hudson as they churned away from the bow of the steamer.
"Uh-huh,"
I said, jabbing a finger on the rail in front of me and thinking about my own life as much as about the story I was listening to. A big gust of cool wind hit the ship, and the doctor drew his jacket tighter.
"It was all unconscious, of course," he said.
"But then, one can be as foolish unconsciously as consciously."
"Eh?"
He took another drag off his stick and turned his back to the wind.
"And then, as I grew older, I realized that my actions had embodied something more sinister than a simple desire to change Frances. I had actually believed that if she failed to change and continued on to the life for which her own silly desires had destined her, it would somehow be my fault."
"Yours?" I said, looking up at him. "How did you figure that?"
He shrugged. "I didn't figure it. I felt it. I was an inexperienced young man, Stevie, one whose relationship to his own mother had failed in some central way. I couldn't help but take the responsibility for that failure on myself. Precisely because of all the things we've talked about, it's unnatural to hold your own mother accountable for terrible wrongs. So I buried such feelings and looked for some other woman whose behavior I could alter. The only blessing is that another equally primitive part of my mind told me I couldn't sacrifice my entire life to such an endeavor. And so I said farewell to Frances."
He shook once in the wind.
"Still, it's an interesting technique. Leaving one person behind in order to find her or him somewhere else. And in someone else."
"Yeah," I said, quietly amazed that, as usual, he'd been able to speak to exactly what was troubling me without ever mentioning my life at all. Then I had a constructive thought of my own. "It's kind of like what we're doing on this job."
"Indeed?"
I nodded. "We're leaving Nurse Hunter in New York to go and find Libby Hatch upstate. Only difference is, they're not like each other, they are each other. So maybe this time that kind of technique can actually work, since it's aimed at the right target. The doctor considered that as he finished off his cigarette.
You know, you may have a talent for this sort of work, Stevie.
He glanced around, then stuck the butt of his cigarette into a nearby bucket of sand.
Well, this wind is stiffening. We've ordered breakfast, steak and eggs for you. Come down when you're ready.
He gave me the quickest of glances, along with that fast but reassuring smile of his. Then, clapping his hands together, he walked back to the stairs, a bit unsteadily in that swelling tidal portion of the lower Hudson, and vanished below. I turned and looked back at the Palisades, feeling for the packet of cigarettes in my pocket, but then I decided against having another one. The horizon before me was beautiful, but it would be beautiful from our parlor, too, and I suddenly realized that my mood was changing, and I didn't want to be alone anymore.
Well, Libby Hatch, I said, looking ahead at the long, wide stretch of the Hudson and then drumming my fingers on the rail as I turned away from it, you got no place left to hide.
I bounded down the stairs that the doctor had taken without ever glancing at the waters behind us. If I had taken a peek in that direction, I would have seen a small steam launch what was trailing behind the Mary Powell as fast as its small engine would permit. And if, having caught sight of said vessel, I'd squinted and looked hard, it's possible I would have made out a small figure standing in its prow, a figure whose dark features, bushy hair, and suit of baggy clothes I would have recognized. But no matter how hard I'd looked, I wouldn't have seen the arsenal of strange weapons from the Orient what the mysterious little character was carrying. For those, he kept hidden from view, until he was ready to strike.
Chapter 28.
When I'd first come to live with the doctor, and undertaken to study, among many other things, the history of my own country, he'd figured that the best place for me to start was close to home. And so my earliest voyages into what was for me a great darkness, the story of the world before my arrival in it, had been made up of books about the history of New York City and New York State. I'd also been on a few trips up north with the doctor when he'd had calls to pay on the penitentiaries and lunatic asylums what were located throughout the Hudson Valley, or when he went to Albany to give testimony to some commission or other about how the state should handle its mentally deranged citizens. So I was no stranger to the beautiful, if slightly spooky, landscape that surrounded us on our very pleasant voyage aboard the Mary Powell that day. All the same, a queer sort of feeling crept into me as we headed upriver, one that I'd never experienced on any of those earlier trips. I found that I was much more aware not just of the misty mountains and green fields that lay beyond the riverbanks, the usual objects of study for the sightseer, but of the towns that were cut into the countryside and the many factory works what had been built over the years and were still being built along the river itself. In other words, the growing presence of people, in what I knew had been just 100 years earlier a wild wilderness, was for some reason weighing heavy on my mind. All through breakfast I wondered what could be making me see things so differently than I ever had before, and I got worried as to whether the change might not be permanent. It wasn't until I went up onto the promenade deck with Miss Howard after breakfast to have a smoke that I started to comprehend my own feelings a little better. It was our recent discovery that Libby Hatch had been born and raised in similar surroundings that was changing my view of the country we were passing through and the people in it so much. This wasn't some quiet, simple region where people lived close to nature and far from the ugliness and violence of cities like New York, I began to see. This was just a string of smaller New Yorks, where certain people engaged in the same kind of disheartening and in some cases sickening behavior that so many folks in the big city did. As this grim realization started to really sink in, I was surprised to find myself making a kind of wish. A wish that the great wilderness, what still dominated up on mountains like the purple Catskills standing in the distance to my left that afternoon, would spread back down over the earth and swallow up the ugly little nests of human beings what had sprung up in the river valley. It was a wish that, true to my original fear, has never really gone away in all the years since. and it certainly wasn't altered any that day when we hit the middle stretch of the Hudson, where the manor houses of the old Dutch and English river families began to dot the hillsides to our right. Mr. Moore came up to join us, and both he and Miss Howard grew very quiet as they stared out toward those heights. I knew that each of them had real cause for sadness, being as they'd both spent much of their bittersweet childhoods there. In Mr. Moore, the scenery obviously brought back memories of the brother whose death had saddened him so and caused such a breach with the rest of his family. Mr. Moore having contended that they'd driven his brother to morphine and drink with their strict Dutch ways. Miss Howard, on the other hand, was clearly thinking about the many summers and autumns she'd spent hunting, shooting, and generally living a boy's life with her beloved father, who'd had no son, nor any other child besides his one daughter, to share his sporting pursuits with. Said father had died in a mysterious hunting accident in amongst those woods some years back, and there'd been talk of suicide. But Miss Howard, who'd taken the death so hard that she'd had to retreat to a sanitarium for a time, had always denied such rumors. Considering all this, it wasn't too surprising to see the pair's spirits sag beyond melancholy as they watched the high hills and the stately houses pass by. And though we eventually went below again to consume a very tasty lunch, and even managed to play a few silly but diverting deck sports afterwards, the general mood among our party remained what you might call reserved. The Mary Powell stopped only briefly in Albany, a bustling city with many factories, railroad tracks, and workers' houses lining its riverfront. Not the kind of scenery that was going to put me or anyone else in a more cheerful state of mind. Many of the steamer's passengers debarked at the state's capital, leaving just them what were finishing off their round trip to New York, along with those of us who were going on through a dredged upper section of the river to Troy. Only a few miles of the riverside between Albany and Troy were still unpopulated, and the fiery, smoky factories that we passed, along with the large groups of dirty, miserable workers who were coming out of them, served to underline the notion that the countryside was becoming even more infected by mankind's petty but brutal desires. As for the city of Troy, it was a prosperous but dreary place, its dozens of brick manufacturing works and cargo steamships fouling the river just so's to make the latest laundry, gardening, and locomotive machinery available to the rest of the world. By the time we left the Mary Powell, a beautiful sunset had begun to appear above the western portion of the city, making me anxious to strike out into the country toward that fiery, sinking ball and away from the city. So it came as a great disappointment to discover, when we reached the Union Depot and the offices of the Delaware and Hudson Canal Railroad Company, that the previous day's great gale had struck this portion of the state, too, and caused a bad derailment on the line between Troy and Boston Spa. We'd have to wait until morning to finish our journey, which meant spending a night in the nearby Union Hotel. Not a terrible joint by any means, but still discouraging for a young man who was chafing to get away from civilization and out into the wilderness. The train ride the next morning offered me some relief, being, as once we'd left Troy and its environs behind, we did start to pass through patches of countryside, what hinted at how magical that part of the state must have been before civilization hit it like a runaway streetcar. There were long stretches of what seemed like ancient woodlands, and we passed by a couple of big silver lakes. But each time we'd quickly move on to some cluster of farms or past a bustling little town, all of which hammered home the point that the old forest was losing its fight for control of the landscape. Before long, the conductor on our train was announcing our approach to Boston Spa, and when we arrived at the town's outskirts, I found that my mood of the day before had returned and maybe even gotten worse. Though such was not a bad outlook to have, I quickly discovered when you were entering the seat of Saratoga County. Cyrus had brought along a little guidebook to the towns of the northern Hudson area, and he read from it as we chugged slowly toward the end of our journey. Boston Spa, I learned, had once been famous for its string of quiet little health retreats, but over the last century things had changed pretty drastically. Many of the mineral springs had dried up, and the spas had been replaced by a collection of mills. In their early days, these large brickworks had produced wool, cotton, linens, and a peculiar battle axe, what looked like a Turkish scimitar, this last for the Union Army during the Civil War. But even the mills had fallen in hard times by 1897. Most of them had been built along a rushing creek what ran through the town, the Cateros, an old Iroquois word what meant something to the effect of stream of the crooked waters. But in the years that followed, so much lumbering had been done around the stream's watershed that the Cateros itself had been reduced to a trickling little creek what couldn't power anything of consequence. So now the black smoke of furnaces poured from the chimneys of the mills, which, though they still made some farm tools, were currently known mostly for paper products. Cyrus's guidebook tried to relate all this information in what you might call a positive fashion, but there wasn't much way to avoid the conclusion that, because of their own short-sightedness, and in the space of just a century, the citizens of Ballston Spa had gone from operating the best health retreats in the north to boasting that their town was home to the world's finest paper bags. The old resort hotels, which couldn't compete with a string of gigantic, luxurious competitors what had opened in nearby Saratoga Springs, had either been converted to boarding houses for factory workers or burned down. Still, nobody ever thought to rename the town, even though by 1897 there wasn't much about Boston that brought the word spa to mind. The train depot sat just below a hill what separated the industrial parts of the town from the homes of the local swells. On top of said hill ran what some imaginative mug had named High Street, where most of the town's churches, along with the county offices, were located. The station building itself wasn't much to look at, just a long, low structure of the type you generally find in such places, and the few people who were standing out on the platform waiting for our train to pull in seemed made to match. All, that is, except for one of them. He was all the way out on the easternmost end of the platform, as if he knew that Mr. Moore liked sitting at the back of trains and would have convinced us all to do likewise, which, in fact, he had. Smoking a pipe like his life depended on it, the short, ginger-haired man was also by turns pulling on a neatly clipped beard and mustache and running a hand through his similarly cut hair, all the while looking in every direction and walking round the platform as if the thing was on fire. His eyes, which I later determined were a very light gray, seemed a sort of silvery color from a distance, and they carried an expression that was both determined and a little wild. He pulled his watch out no less than 3 times while our train was slowing to a stop, just why I couldn't say, seeing as we'd already arrived, and each time he tucked it away with a look of worry, then smoked and paced some more. I lost sight of the fellow as we made our way to the door of our car, but somehow I knew this was the man we'd come to see. Mr. Moore turned to the rest of us as the train groaned and squeaked into the station. "All right, listen, all of you," he said, his voice urgent. "Especially you, Kreisler. There's one thing I neglected to mention about Rupert, because I didn't want to discourage you from trusting the case to him. He truly is brilliant, but, well, the fact of the matter is, he can't shut up." The rest of us looked at each other with expressions what indicated a shared belief that this must be some kind of gag. "What do you mean, Moore?" the doctor asked. "If he's excessively verbal—" "No," Mr. Moore answered. "I mean he can't shut up." Marcus laughed. "Of course he can't. He's a lawyer, for God's sake." "No," Mr. Moore said again. "It's something more, something physical. He's been to doctors about it. Some kind of compulsion or something. I forget what they call it." "Pressured speech?" the doctor guessed, looking intrigued. Mr. Moore snapped his fingers. "That's it. Anyway, it works wonders in court, but in conversation it can be a little much." Banging into the closed front door of our car as the train came to a halt, Mr. Moore started for the steps. "I just wanted to warn you, he's as nice a person as you'll ever meet. But thoughts just come into his head and shoot right out of his mouth. So don't take anything he says too personally, all right?" Checking each of our faces, Mr. Moore nodded once, and then we followed him out onto the platform. Mr. Rupert Picton was still pacing and smoking, those big silver eyes looking very anxious. When Mr. Moore saw the sight, he grinned in a heartfelt way. "Picton," he called, walking toward his friend on the platform. "Good God, man, you look like you're going to have kittens. Your train's late," answered Mr. Picton, smiling through what he seemed to realize was very obvious nervousness. "They're always late these days. We can talk about going to war with Spain, but we can't make our trains run on time. How are you, John?" "Fine, fine," Mr. Moore answered, as the rest of us joined him. "Let me introduce you to the others. This is Miss Sarah Howard."
"Hello, Mr. Picton," Miss Howard said, extending a hand. "I'm afraid I'm the one who started all this unfortunate business."
"Nonsense, Miss Howard," Mr. Picton answered, shaking her hand vigorously and talking not only a lot but at a very fast pace. "You mustn't think that way. You didn't start it. Libby Hatch did, when she first drew innocent blood and found that she had a taste for it. What you have started is an end to her sinister tale, and you should be proud that... Ah, and here's Dr. Kreitzler."
The active little hand shot out again. "I recognize you from the pictures that have appeared with your monographs, sir.
Fascinating work, yours is fascinating."
"Thank you, Mr. Picton. It's kind of you to..." But Mr. Picton had already turned to Lucius and Marcus. He grinned and grabbed each of their hands in turn.
"And I assume that you gentlemen are the detective sergeants, Isaacson?"
Marcus smiled and had just managed to say, "Why, yes," before he was cut off.
"Don't go crediting me with any powers of detection," Mr. Picton said. "None greater than smell, at any rate. There is a vague aroma of sulfuric acid."
Lucius cast his brother a hard glance as he took his turn shaking Mr. Picton's hand.
"I'm sorry about that, sir. If someone hadn't made me perform that strychnine test again before we left New York..." "I hope you've brought all your chemicals and devices along,"
Mr. Picton answered, nodding encouragingly.
"We'll need them. Now then, let's get your things together."
Cyrus and I, having found a porter to help us tend to the baggage as we watched all this, now approached the group from behind our host. Cyrus cleared his throat just once, but once was enough to make Mr. Picton, who hadn't seen us coming, shoot into the air.
"Great jumping cats!" he cried, spinning on Cyrus. "Who are you? Ah, don't tell me. John wrote about you. You're Dr. Kreitzler's man, correct? Mr.
"May I present Mr. Cyrus Montrose?" the doctor said, at which Mr. Picton shook Cyrus's big hand, "as well as Master Stevie Taggart, both associates of mine."
Mr. Picton turned his hand in my direction, and I stuck my own out to receive his jolting shake.
"Master Taggart, good to meet you. Well..."
He stood back and put his hands to his hips, taking us in.
"So this is the group that has actually put fear into that murderess's heart, eh? I admire you for it, I must say. Libby Hatch certainly never had anything to be nervous about in this county, I can tell you. Let's get your bags onto my rig and get over to my place. We need to get to business as soon as we can. Porter, follow me."
"Your place?" Mr. Moore said. "But, Rupert, I made reservations at the Eagle Hotel..."
"And I canceled them," Mr. Picton answered. "I've got a house big enough for a regiment, John, with just me and the housekeeper. I won't hear of you staying anywhere else."
"But," Mr. Moore said carefully, as we made for an old Surrey when it was standing outside the station,
"are you sure you're up to it, Rupert? I mean, I heard you weren't well."
"Not well?" Mr. Picton thundered back.
"Why, I'm as sound as a dollar. In fact, I'm even sounder, given the current strength of our currency. Oh, I know what they said in New York before I left, John, and I'll admit that I needed a rest at the time. You know my disposition. High-strung I am, certainly. You'll get no argument from me. But those rumors about my suffering a breakdown were just further attempts to discredit what I was saying."
Yes, I'm acquainted with that phenomenon," the doctor said, as Mr. Picton began to lob our luggage from the porter's truck into his surrey, smoking furiously all the while.
"Yes, I understand you are, Dr. Kreitzler," our host answered. "I understand you are, and so you probably know the weariness it breeds. Trying to stop what was going on in the district attorney's office fairly well exhausted me, as I say, and wore my nerves positively raw. But that's a far cry from madness, don't you think?"
"Well..." the doctor answered slowly. Too slowly, it turned out, for Mr. Picton.
"Exactly my point," he said. "It's a funny world we're living in, Dr. Kreitzler, and I don't mean funny in the amusing sense, where a man can be labeled mad simply for trying to expose egregious corruption. Ah, well, no matter."
Tossing the last of our bags into the surrey, Mr. Picton made for the driver's bench.
"Climb aboard, everyone. Mr. Montrose, perhaps you and Master Taggart might not mind riding on the steps there. You can get a grip on the canopy, and we're not going far."
"Fine with me," I said happily, finding that I was starting to enjoy Mr. Picton's slightly crazy way of saying and doing things.
"Of course, sir," Cyrus said, also taking an outside perch after the others had climbed aboard.
"Good men," Mr. Picton said with a grin, saluting us with his pipe. "Hang on now, here we go."
The surrey began to roll, but we hadn't even gotten out of the station yard before Mr. Picton had started in again.
"As I say, Doctor, it doesn't matter, really. All that business in New York and what those people may have said about me doesn't matter at all, not in the long term. The world is going to hell in a heck, and New York will be one of the first places to arrive, if it hasn't already, and I could make a case for it having done so.
That's one of the reasons I came back to Boston. It's actually possible to do an occasional bit of good here without having to worry about the magnates and the bosses." He let out a few more smokestack blasts with his pipe as he steered his horse along a street that ran west below the steepled hill. "But don't let's get drawn too far into this sort of talk. We have other matters that are pressing." He took out his watch and checked it again. "Pressing indeed. You must all get settled in and fed. Mrs. Hastings will see to that, my housekeeper." He shook his head as we rattled our way toward the western edge of town. "Terrible case. She and her husband ran a dry goods store together for most of their lives. Then, a couple of years ago, three local toughs, not all that much older than you, Master Taggart, robbed the place while she was out. Beat her husband to death with a shovel. I prosecuted the case, and afterwards she came to work for me, as much out of gratitude as anything else, I think."
"Gratitude?" Miss Howard asked. "Because you helped her through a difficult time?"
"Because I made sure those three boys went to the electrical chair," Mr. Picton answered. "Ah, there's my house now, at the end of the street."
Mr. Picton had a mansion-sized place at the juncture of Charlton and High Streets, not too far from the courthouse and close to the old Aldridge Spa, currently a boarding house, and the iron railing spring, the pair of which were the last real remains of the town's salad days as a health resort. To judge by the four big turrets what formed the corners of Mr. Picton's house, along with the wide porch what was wrapped around the whole structure, it wasn't as old as many of the residences we'd seen and passed. But the size alone was enough to give it kind of an eerie quality, and I wondered why a man would choose to live alone with his housekeeper in such a building. The front and rear gardens were full of climbing roses and ivy that had gone a little berserk, along with a couple of elm trees what must have been considerably older than the house itself, all of which only added to the feeling that this was a very ghostly dwelling, indeed.
"My father built it for my mother," Mr. Picton explained as we neared the house, "and 35 years ago it was considered the height of Victorian Gothic style. Nowadays, well, fashion has never mattered much to me, so I've left it more or less as it was. Mrs. Hastings is constantly after me to redecorate, but, oh, there she is now."
A round, kindly-looking woman of about 60 or so, wearing a blue dress with a white apron, came out the front door of the house just as we pulled into the yard. Mr. Picton drew the surrey to a stop, and then smiled as he waved to his housekeeper.
"Mrs. Hastings, you see, I managed to find them without any trouble. I trust the turret rooms are all ready?"
"Oh, yes, Your Honor," Mrs. Hastings answered, wiping her flour and food-coated hands on her apron and smiling warmly.
"And lunch is waiting for you all. Welcome, welcome. It'll be a real breath of fresh air, it will, having guests."
Mr. Picton made the introductions, and then the others started toward the house, while Cyrus and I hung back to unload the bags.
"Well," I said quietly to my big friend, "what do you think?"
Cyrus shook his head once. "He's a character, all right. Mr. Moore sure wasn't exaggerating about that talking business."
"I like him," I said, starting toward the front door with a batch of suitcases. Looking up at the high walls and dark turrets before me, I paused for a minute. "The house looks like it might have a ghost or two, though,"
I whispered over my shoulder. Cyrus smiled and shook his head again. "You always like the odd ones," he said.
Then his face went straight.
"But I don't want to hear any more about ghosts."
The ground floor of Mr. Picton's house had a reception room what might have served as a convention hall, stocked to overflowing with heavy velvet-upholstered furniture that was centered around a carved stone fireplace you could have walked right into. It also contained the usual recreational items like a piano and a big card table. At the center of the house was a staircase made out of heavy, polished oak, and then, mirroring the reception room on the other side of the stairs, there was an enormous dining room crammed full of chairs, sideboards, and a table what were all in the same style as the things in the living room. The bedrooms on the upper floors, located, as Mr. Picton had said, in the four-corner turrets, were of similarly huge dimensions, each with its own big fireplace and most with their own baths. By the time I got upstairs, the others were roaming around shopping for rooms, and I could hear Mr. Picton saying, "Oh, good choice, Miss Howard. That's really the best room in the house. You get a splendid view of the garden and the stream." On the third floor, I could hear the detective sergeants arguing over another bedroom, but I couldn't make out what had become of the doctor and Mr. Moore, whose suitcases I was carrying. Then the sound of low conversation came from down one long hall, and I followed it to find the two of them in yet another bedroom. "Chrysler, I swear to you, I don't know," Mr. Moore was saying as I reached the door, "and I don't think he does either, or at least he's never told me."
"There are several manias that could account for it," the doctor said carefully, "and some of them are degenerative."
He gave Mr. Moore what you might call an uncertain look.
"We're risking a great deal on this man, John."
"Laszlo, listen to me. It has never impaired his work. It used to be a bit of a joke in social situations, but in the courtroom, it's a genuine boon. He can absolutely overwhelm defense lawyers when he gets going." Mr. Moore stopped as he caught sight of me at the door. Then he smiled, thankful for a way, I think, to end his conversation with the doctor. "Hello, Stevie. Got my things by any chance?" Ignoring the question, I just shrugged, looked to the doctor, and repeated what I'd said to Cyrus. "I like him." "There you are," Mr. Moore announced, taking two of the suitcases from me. "What is it they say about children and dogs being the best judges of character, Chrysler? I don't remember alienists elbowing their way onto the list any time recently."
"I assure you both, my concern in no way reflects on the man's character," the doctor said. "He seems entirely straightforward and likable. And that's not a bad bit of work for a lawyer. Nor am I saying that his difficulty is without doubt mental or emotional in origin. There are several physical pathologies that could easily be responsible."
Mr. Moore nodded once. "All right, then, let's drop this business for now."
"For now," the doctor agreed, taking his suitcases from me and then examining my neck and hands.
"Good Lord, Stevie," he said with a combination of a scowl and a laugh, "what have you been doing? Make certain you find a washroom before lunch, young man." Once Cyrus and I had all the bags inside, I took a bedroom up on the third floor with the detective sergeants and went into the bathroom to wash up before lunch. The noise of the running water bounced off the marble and tiles of the big chamber to the point where it sounded as though I might be standing by a waterfall. Everything in that house, it seemed, was unusually large, cavernous even. And as I dried my face, neck, and hands, I began to wonder who would have built such a place and what had become of them. But funnily enough, there was no longer any fear in the wondering. Huge and mysterious as the house might be, I found that Mr. Picton filled it with a feverish but friendly kind of activity, and that I'd stopped feeling like I might be in a dangerous spot. Starting back down toward the ground floor in the dining room where the others were already collected, I ran my hand along the fat banister of the staircase and suddenly realized that it would be just the thing for sliding. I didn't know why the thought of it should have occurred to me. I only knew that it was the first really amusing idea that I'd had in days. So I looked down, scouted the ground floor hallway, and, not seeing anyone, decided to give the banister a try. Feeling ever more playful and relaxed, I climbed aboard on the second floor landing and gave myself a little push off, and in about a second and a half found myself sprawled on the floor in the front hall. The banister had been even more suitable, which is to say slippery, than I'd figured, and after flying off of it, I'd hit the hallway carpet at high speed, sliding across the polished floor and into the front door with a crash. That brought the others out of the dining room and produced a look of shock on the doctor's face.
"Stevie," he said, "what in the world—"
"Ha!" Mr. Picton bellowed, snatching his pipe out of his mouth and leaning back to have a good laugh. Then he came over to help me up. "More slippery than it looks, eh, Master Taggart? Don't be embarrassed. The same thing happened to me the first time I tried it, and that was just a few years ago. Nothing broken, I hope." I shook my head, feeling my face go red, but Mr. Picton's open confession of similar foolery made me feel much better about it. "Good," he went on. "Then come in and have some lunch, and afterwards I'll show you a few tricks that'll keep your speed down and your backside intact." I followed the others into the dining room, getting another perplexed look from the doctor as I went. Mr. Picton insisted on escorting each of us to our seats and further insisted that the doctor take the head of the table. "I'm perfectly happy at the foot," he said when the doctor protested. "And this is your investigation, doctor. I don't want you to think for a minute that I don't understand that. We'll have a great deal to discuss at this table, and I want you to consider me simply your latest ally and pupil."
"That is gracious indeed, Mr. Picton," the doctor said in an even tone as he carefully and curiously studied our host.
Mr. Picton took his seat at the foot of the table and rang a small bell, at which Mrs. Hastings appeared through a swinging door what led through to the kitchen. She was carrying the first of many platters of food. "All from the farms and streams of our own county," Mr. Picton explained, "and, though simply prepared, no less appetizing for its humility. John, there's some decent claret on the side table there, if you wouldn't mind pouring."
As Mr. Moore eagerly moved to follow the order, Mr. Picton looked my way.
"And we have a full case of root beer in the kitchen for you, Master Taggart. Mrs. Hastings will bring you a bottle. John tells me you are a devotee, and I confess I have a weakness for the stuff myself."
Glancing around the table as the rest of us started heaping chicken, brook trout, sweet peas, baby carrots, and mashed potatoes onto our plates, Mr. Picton held up his glass.
"And so, welcome, all of you."
He took a deep drink, and then his silvery eyes opened wide.
"Now then, let me tell you what I know about Libby Hatch."
Chapter 29.
"She arrived here," Mr. Picton began as he put some food onto his own plate, "just over 10 years ago, as near as I can tell, from Stillwater."
"Yes," Miss Howard said. "She listed it as her place of birth on one of the hospital forms we saw."
"Did she?" Mr. Picton answered. "Well, that was just another lie, I'm afraid. I have checked the birth records of every town in this county. There's no listing for an Elspeth Fraser, which was her name back then. She did, however, live in Stillwater for a time, though just how long, I don't know."
"And you never ascertained where she actually was born during your investigation?"
the doctor asked, a little surprised.
"You proceed from the assumption that I was allowed to conduct an investigation, Doctor. The case of Libby Hatch, her assault at children, and the phantom Negro never got past a coroner's inquest. My superior at the time could find no justification for either the effort or the expense of a formal investigation, and neither could the sheriff."
"There's nothing unusual in that, unfortunately," Marcus said. "I doubt if there's one case in 20 involving dead children that gets past a coroner's inquest. The crimes are too private. It's just too damn difficult to figure out who did what."
Mr. Picton looked up with some interest.
"I get the feeling you've had some legal training, Detective."
Marcus had just filled his mouth with some of the sweet, buttery peas, so it was Lucius who answered.
"Marcus was on his way to becoming a lawyer when we got involved in police work instead. I was slated for medicine."
"I see," Mr. Picton said, smiling and looking very interested.
"Well, your analysis is correct, though I'd say your numbers are a little low. I'd be surprised if one child's death in 100 is really investigated, and when a white woman claims that a colored man is responsible, I'm sure Mr. Montrose is aware that racial bias is very much alive in the North."
Cyrus just bent his head a little, as if to say he was only too aware of that fact.
"So I wasn't really surprised that the district attorney and the sheriff were so willing to accept Libby's version of events. As for me, I confess I wasn't yet aware of what bearing the woman's background might have had on the matter. You see, Dr. Chrysler, I hadn't yet encountered your writings, your theory of context, and I was fairly focused on the circumstantial evidence."
The doctor gave a polite little shrug to that.
"Circumstantial and forensic evidence are invaluable, Mr. Picton. That is why we depend so much on the detective sergeants. But there are crimes that offer few such clues, and that cannot be solved if the personal lives of the participants are not studied in depth."
"Oh, I completely agree with you now,"
Mr. Picton answered, eating his food in quick little movements, like an animal or a bird.
"But then, as I say, I hadn't really been exposed to the concept. The only thing I thought might prove or disprove Mrs. Hatch's claim was the apprehension of the mysterious Negro, and I unofficially pressed that search as hard and for as long as I could. But after a time, the district attorney ordered me to give up the hunt and forget the affair. Now, however, I can see that the few facts I did assemble about Mrs. Hatch during that brief time may be relevant somehow."
"Very much so," the doctor answered. "Detective Sergeant?"
Lucius already had his small pad out.
"Yes, sir, I'm on it."
"Oh, and Mr. Picton," the doctor paused to take a sip of his wine, "is there a store in town where we might purchase a chalkboard?"
"A chalkboard?" Mr. Picton repeated. "How large?"
"As large as possible, and as soon as possible."
Mr. Picton thought the matter over.
"No, I can't think—"
Then his face brightened.
"Wait a minute, Mrs. Hastings."
The housekeeper appeared almost immediately.
"Mrs. Hastings, would you mind telephoning over to the high school? Tell Mr. Quinn that I'd like to borrow one of his largest chalkboards."
"A chalkboard?"
Mrs. Hastings repeated, moving around the table to refill the wine glasses.
"What in heaven's name would Your Honor want with a chalkboard, and where would we put such a thing?"
"Mrs. Hastings, please, the matter is very urgent," Mr. Picton said, "and I don't know how many times I have to tell you. I'm an assistant district attorney at home, not a judge in a courtroom. You really don't need to address me as Your Honor."
"Hmm," Mrs. Hastings grunted, turning and making for the kitchen again. "As if that fool jury would have convicted those boys without your driving them to it."
She pounded her way back through the swinging door. Our host smiled in his nervous, quick way, tugging at his beard and then his hair.
"I think we can find something that will suit your needs, Doctor. And so, we return to the facts of Libby Hatch's background, or at least to what bits and pieces I eventually assembled. Libby Fraser, as I say, was her name when she arrived here. She tried to get all sorts of employment in town, but nothing worked out. She was too headstrong to follow the rules of conduct at the telephone exchange, expressed too many opinions about